out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 12th of September 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we are broadcasting live today at radioarian.com because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Matt, good afternoon. How are you doing, sir?
How does it feel? How does it feel, really, to be talking to the guy who wrote the very first article questioning 9/11? On the very day as it was going on with John Tiffany, who, by the way, believed that somehow Chilean revolutionaries were behind the events of 9/11 because that was the day that Allende was overthrown. I disabused him of that pretty quickly. But how does it feel? How does it feel? Are you overwhelmed? You should be overwhelmed.
Well,
I'll be offended if you're not overwhelmed.
I tell you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, wow, you got a good memory, remembering everything else that was going on back then. And obviously it shows, you know, you've been into analyzing this sort of thing for longer than myself. I mean, you go back decades where you've been questioning the original narrative. And of course, we do want to talk today about 9/11. Well, what was it in your article that you wrote back then? What was it that you were pointing out there, Matt?
I don't even remember if it was a Spotlight or the American Free Press. I think it may have been the very end of the Spotlight. I don't remember exactly. It may have been the very end of the Spotlight. I never see these things once they get published, but the article is a very simple one. I wrote it as the towers were coming down or immediately afterwards, because the press within 15 minutes, every news channel, we were watching CNBC, but every news channel said the same thing, that they were certain it was Osama bin Laden. Now, the New York Times had just reported that he was very, very ill in Pakistan. And the first thing I noted was, because I followed I followed his career after the explosion that Al-Qaeda caused on the USS Cole. And because of that, all of his accounts were frozen. He was being watched like a hawk. They knew exactly where he was. He didn't have a penny to his name at the time. And how the heck could they possibly know in 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes at the most, with certainty that it was him? I don't remember. I watched everything. I read everything at the time. I was working for Willis Carto at the time. This is all we talked about. No one mentioned any other figure or organization or group in the major press, except for John Tiffany, of course, but we're not really the major press. I remember every damn thing that day, except where it went. I don't remember if it was the American Free Press, because that was right when the Spotlight had gone out of business and Willis started the AFP. I don't remember. It was right at that point. I don't remember which one it is, but it was simple. How could they possibly know this? And the New York Times is saying that they knew where he was at the time, that he died in December of that year. And he was a very, very sick man. But once the USS Cole blew up, and that was his previous terrorist exercise prior to 9/11, was pushing a raft full of explosives out to the USS Cole, an American Navy ship, killed a few sailors. I said, well, that's one hell of a learning curve. He goes from pushing a raft to this incredible dance of these huge planes with no money. We knew. I mean, the press was saying all of his accounts were frozen. Most of his money was in dollars because of his connection with Saudi Arabia. And then that very day, maybe near the end of that day, They were blaming somehow the Taliban in Afghanistan, which is a group that I knew well at the time. So these people are poverty stricken. Are you kidding me? The whole thing was so laughable. But no one knew who Osama was at the time. No one remembered the cold or that this man was being watched like a hawk and all of his people were being watched like hawks. And then, on the 12th of September, the commander of the Russian Air Force, Anatoly Kornukov, said that it was impossible that this act of terror could be accomplished, because he says in Russia now, and remember, this is in 2001, he says the notification and control system for any air transport in Russia does not allow for any uncontrolled flights. It would lead to an immediate reaction from the anti-missile defense system. And he said as soon as something like that would happen, he was reported immediately, and in a minute, we are all up. That's his phrase. We're all up. I have the feeling, I don't know if he means jets or them or whatever it is. And he said he can't imagine that the U.S. was that much inferior to Russia at the time. But he said any uncontrolled flight, a flight just can't go where it wants. That will immediately alert missile defense. That's the first thing that I said, and that apparently got everything rolling. But I think it was the spotlight. I think it was the spotlight. Chris Pethrick was there, John Tiffany was there, Michael Collins Piper was there. So we all did something, you know, together and separately. So I guess I share that honor with them. But it was on the very day, yeah.
I think that was a pattern that was repeated, because I can remember being surprised that they knew who it was instantly. It was somebody that I'd never heard of before. And then when we had the 7/7 bombings over here in London, straight away they were saying it's Islamic terrorism. At the minute it had happened. And you thought, well, how can they know who was actually responsible for it? And that was a pattern that followed since then. And they seemed to know who it was instantly. Something happened. They would instantly name who it was that had actually carried this out. So that was the first suspicious thing. I can remember on the actual day seeing the BBC talking about it and watching the Building 7 just fall down behind her. It was quite shocking, but there were other things that happened after that. We were shown a passport. Apparently a passport managed to survive all of this. The way that the buildings just collapsed. And also telephone calls, when you can't actually make telephone calls from airplanes. I believe that's something that you wanted to concentrate on, Matt. Is that right? These telephone calls? Because I can remember hearing them on the news, these panicked people that were apparently phoning home or phoning up for help. And yet that technology wasn't available back then, I don't think.
Well, there was a... there was an experiment done in 2003 by A.K. Dudney, who for a long time wrote a column in Scientific American. And he said that cell phone calls, even at lower altitudes, would be almost impossible. His initial experiments were just in single and double engine airplanes, smaller ones, and he couldn't do it. And he said, well, with a much larger airline, the insulation is so much greater that the handshake method that the cell phones used at the time wouldn't allow for it. And then, of course, here I'm not too far from the Shanksville, PA site. And, of course, that was an American Airlines plane that did not have the air phone system. Now, of course, initially it was all cell phones. Within 6 months, they changed it to air phones. Because once they realized the cell phone story wasn't going to work, they switched it to the satellite air phones. If you remember those, no one ever used them. They were terrible. They cost about $1 million a second to use. They had been in American, but long before 9/11, they were deactivated. And because maybe no one, I never saw anyone use them before. I flew a lot back then. No one ever used them before. They were too expensive and you couldn't keep a phone call for more than 6 seconds. And in these cases, whether it be Todd Beamer, the guy who said, let's roll, all that stuff. This is all not, he was on the phone for something like 20 minutes, which would have been absolutely impossible. Then that let's roll comment of his, which never happened, was the title of a book, and George Bush used it in his speech for the start of the war, a war on people that had nothing to do with this and couldn't have anything to do with it. So yeah, as far as the cell phones really got to me, because really no one knew anything about them back then. We all called them cellular phones back then still. Very few people had them. The technology was completely different, but they needed a human interest side of this. And so they concocted these long conversations that never got dropped. The woman, Todd Beamer called a woman named Jefferson at the GTC Airphone Chicago call center. That's who he calls, by the way, for a hijacking, calls a call center in Chicago. And she said she thought it was a fake call because he was totally calm. There was no noise. It never didn't get dropped, although the GTE system was overwhelmed at the time. Because United Airlines did have them, but they were extremely unreliable. And she never said anything about let's roll, which, of course, you know, she wrote a book on that much later on. But the initial FBI reports, the trial of Mousawi, all of this stuff isn't mentioned. By the time the first 9/11 report comes out, it had been switched over to airphones, including the Shanksville PA, even though American Airlines didn't have it, didn't have them. They even have, if you go over to the museum here, I could take a quick drive now. They have, of course, a miraculously surviving airphone in the little museum that they have there. It hit the ground at 600 miles an hour. Very little debris, very little anything found, even though they claim they have found 90% of the plane. And yet there is a surviving airphone almost intact in the museum. And they're certain that that's the one that he used. Or she used, I should say, in that case, it was Amy Sweeney, that she used to call, to call home. So, you know, and so they had to switch it from cell phones to airphones. And then there became – initially, it was 1,000 people were calling from the air. Then it was down to just a handful. So by the time the report came out, they dropped a lot of these people. But the biggest one, of course, was Let's Roll from Flight 11, which, you know, again, couldn't have happened. Not to mention the fact that Jefferson herself reported that the phone stayed connected 15 minutes after the crash. Not to mention, calls from that number were being made after the crash, according to Verizon. So, you know, it was ridiculous, and it became one of the weak links, one of the many weak links of the 9/11 story.
And it survived the crash, the same as the passport survived the crash. Well, you brought up attacking the Taliban there. And wasn't Iraq also attacked? Or wasn't it used as it seemed to me it was used as an excuse to go into Afghanistan. It was used as an excuse to have a war in Iraq, and it was used as an excuse for the Patriot Act, which was an intrusion into people's individual freedoms. And I can remember George Bush saying, "Everybody has to go out shopping. That's how we're going to show them that we're not going to allow them to win. Everybody go out and spend money on your credit cards and go shopping." And I can remember thinking how shallow that was. And what would be the point of everybody getting themselves into debt and using their credit cards? You know, I wasn't aware of how the banking system worked at the time. And he started this war on terror, which is still going on today. And we've still got war going on in Afghanistan. We've still got people that are dying in Afghanistan, and it all goes back to this point. And alongside that as well, this term false flag became modern parlance. It seemed to hit the national consciousness, the fact that the governments of some countries may actually benefit from attacking themselves and pretending that it was somebody else. And obviously this is something that the military have always used, but I don't think it was such a popular term as it became around that time, because obviously 911, people were saying, well, this is a false flag because it has served the security services with this Patriot Act, because it has served Zionist interests in taking out Iraq and going into Afghanistan. So it seems as if this could have been carried out by the government itself. And then everything suddenly became a false flag, and whatever happened, it was accused of being a false flag. And we had this movement, it started off as the 911 truth movement, and then that became the truth movement and conspiracy theory stuff. And then you got Alex Jones, who got really big, and you had this big movement, this truth movement that was really sort of started with 911 and was basically just trying to expose all these lies that the government had told about us. So it had some bad effects as far as individual liberties are concerned, and as far as going to war in Afghanistan is concerned. But at the same time, it also helped to wake people up to the fact that the government aren't always good. And there are things that are going on behind the scenes that we're not aware of. And, and from that comes the truth movement, comes the conspiracy theory movement, and comes this rise in nationalism, I think. You can trace it back to this event, do you think?
Well, it was the first major act of terror like that in the age of the internet, because prior to that, it was the Oklahoma City bombing, and that got it started, but the web had just been invented. Or just have been made public. So 2001 is the first, earth-shattering event that had the web along with major media. Now, I know polls these days show that very few people buy the official report for one reason or another. I mean, it could be that the towers themselves or the planes or the fact that, there's a group called Pilots for Truth. And these are all professional pilots who say you couldn't control a plane that large, that low to the ground, at that speed to hit the trade towers. Because his, I forget his name, but the whole website is, I think, is well known now, that at low altitudes, the air is much thicker, and those speeds are simply, I think they said it was like 500 miles an hour, was the official report, something like that. And they came out and said, this is ridiculous, because the air is so thick, it could never, the engines couldn't process it. And trying to control a plane at that low, at that speed, is impossible. And these guys, not only did they find the passport just gently laying on top of debris, but then the How to Fly a Plane book in their car. It's like little kids came up with this. So very little effort came into this. At this point now, I can't respect anyone who accepts the full story. All we know for certain is who benefited from it. The one group of people who, and by the way, the Taliban condemned this. They said, if it's true, then it's not acceptable in Islam because it kills so many innocent people. That's still on their website today. The only person, the other person who condemned it was Osama bin Laden. Every terrorist group on the planet was taking credit for 9/11, like they usually do. Everyone but him, or whoever his second in command was, because he was in no position at the time. He had no money. He was being watched. This simply couldn't have been done. So, it just, when you think about this, the disasters in their storytelling is bad. But as far as the phones are concerned, yeah, they needed this let's roll. They needed these tearful goodbyes and everything else. And yeah, it simply didn't happen. And if that didn't happen, if they lied about that, they lied about a lot of other things.
Well, there was also rumors that it was miniature nuclear bombs that went off that took the towers down. There was rumors of it being thermite. And then that progressed into people saying that there were actually no planes. And it was all some kind of projection that people saw these planes that were going into the buildings and then they were blown up. There was somebody else that was talking about sound weapons. A lot of crazy ideas to explain this, because it seemed to defy the laws of physics. that these two planes, because when you think of a plane, it's not like a ship. It's not made of solid steel. It's made of the lightest, thinnest metal that they can actually come up with. The sort of thing that's going to crumple when it hits concrete, not go through it in the way that it did, and then cause the buildings to completely collapse. So there are all these questions that people had about it, but it just defied physics. And then you've got the dancing Israelis that said that they were there to document it. You've got the person that, I forget, it was a Jewish guy that actually owned the towers, and he had taken out an insurance deal just before that happened.
Silverstein.
Yeah. Can you go into that a bit more? Do you know about that, the insurance deal?
Yeah, he developed a new policy, signed a new policy shortly before the events of 9/11. And I think most of our listeners know that. He got $1 billion was what the policy was for. But then he sued the insurance company, saying that, oh, no, it's $1 billion per tower, not all the towers. He's talking about the two big ones. And he won. So he got $2 billion. So he was able to manipulate the media was manipulated too in that respect. Yeah, he said it was just brand new. It was, I don't remember exactly when he signed it, but it was just before 9/11. And it was for a huge payout. And it covered things just like that. And so the insurance company said, sure, well, that's never going to happen. So they did it. And so he took him to court and said, oh, no, it's the payout is per tower, not the towers as a unit. But, you know, I was born and raised about an hour, 45 minutes from the Twin Towers. We learned about them in school. We learned about how they were constructed. We learned about all that. I mean, in grammar school and in high school. I don't think people realize the incredibly strict standards that the city of New York and the state of New York put on the builders of these. It was very explicit. I remember learning this in school. It had to take not just one hit from a jumbo jet, but numerous hits from a jumbo jet without falling over, with the idea it would kill so many people in Manhattan. That the steel that they used was custom made. It wasn't regular steel. It was extremely purified. It was coated. It was extremely expensive, only used for this. The city of New York, if you're going to build something this high, it has to be absolutely invincible. This is a huge city. If anything happens, you're going to kill a lot of people. And the builders were hemmed and hawed. I think there was even a lawsuit. It was so much more expensive than they had expected. The regulations got worse and worse as time went on. The thing was a fortress. I've been in them 1,000 times. My best friend in college worked there. My brother-in-law worked there. I know them. And people used to talk about it. People used to talk about these things are just, you know, they're fortresses in terms of strength. And the city demanded it. And they were regularly inspected. To think that a jumbo jet, even if it could hit something like that, could bring it down with such perfect precision, is laughable. And people talk about the melting point of steel. Well, this isn't regular steel. This is far more pure. This is far stronger than ordinary steel. That's one thing I distinctly remember from school, is that was a whole big discussion. The regulations on the materials used for building this had to be extremely high quality. So I knew the whole thing was nonsense.
Well, hang on a minute, Matt. Hang on a minute. You're saying that, you know, they had these limits to how the steel had to be, and they had these recommendations, and it had to be a certain type, and it had to be built in a certain way. What if they'd cut corners? What if they'd used cheap concrete and thought, well, there's no way that an aeroplane is ever going to hit this, and we want to make a profit here, so we're going to make it out of cheap materials? What if there'd been diversity hires there, and they cut corners, and they used cheap materials to make the building, and it looked to all intents and purposes as if it had been made out of the correct materials, but it was actually made out of cheaper stuff so that they could make a profit.
First of all, the biggest worry was that planes were going to hit this, because the air traffic over Manhattan is pretty tremendous. And not really jumbo jets, but they're worried about helicopters and smaller planes. And the construction process was watched by the city. I can't imagine how you could pull that off. You know, they complained so loudly. There was at least one lawsuit over this, saying you're coming up with regulations as you go. And because of the bad blood between the builders and the city, I'm pretty certain that the city was going to watch them pretty carefully. They didn't want these towers. When they were proposed years ago, they said, it's too high. It's too dangerous. If anything were to happen, it would wipe out all of Manhattan. They're too damn high. Air traffic, there's too many issues here. So they didn't want them in the first place. And so when they broke ground finally, it was a very, very contentious process. So, I mean, it's conceivable, but I really doubt it. The towers were meant to be indestructible, especially from air traffic, because that was a big complaint. And if you read, there's several books on the construction of the towers. Planes hitting it was a big deal. You know, this is, you know, a long time ago. They were worried about it. You have tremendous air traffic there. You have airports very close by. You have low flying planes. It's not, you know, it was considered, it was the big complaint. This has to be able to withstand pretty much anything. And it's always been inspected. It's inspected all the time, even after it's built. You know, the elevator always gave them problems because there had to be, the elevators go in shifts. You can't have one long elevator for the whole thing. It has to be, so you get off like in the middle of it and go into another elevator and that takes you the rest of the way. It simply was too high for one elevator. That was always giving them problems. So, you know, this was always under inspection by the city, a city that didn't want them. Thought that they were just simply too high. And so they dumped all these regulations. So, you know, they were watched very closely. People underestimate how powerful the mayor of New York City is. All the money that's in Manhattan, especially. So, you know, it's conceivable, but I don't see it.
Well, another point I think we should talk about a little bit is the fact that it was Islamic terrorism, and everybody was saying, "Well, it's a false flag." And as I was alluding to earlier, that there were more attacks, and people would say, "Well, it's a false flag." And since then, there have been so many attacks that have been carried out by Muslims that you know, people have stopped really using this false flag terminology now, and we've got used to the fact that yes, extremist Muslims do carry out suicide bombings and they do carry out these attacks, and we've seen them happen throughout Europe, but that really hadn't happened at this time. I don't think there'd been any Islamic terror attacks in Europe at the time. I don't think there had been any in America at the time. This was the first one, and then since then, over the last 18 years, we've seen an increase in them, so many that there's just too many to list now. But back then, at the time, it was seen that it's more likely that it's a false flag than Muslims would be doing something like this. Why would Muslims be doing something like this? You know, there's been a complete change in the way that Islam has been seen since then, I think.
It doesn't take a genius to figure out that it was not in their interest to do this. The Taliban made it very clear at the time. This is going to guarantee that infidel soldiers are going to be in the Middle East pretty much forever. It gives the people something to rally behind. It's, if you remember that very day, Israel invaded the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, absorbing them entirely. No one even noticed that. It was not in the interests of Islam, which is why Osama bin Laden had distanced himself from it. And the Taliban, who never liked Osama, he saw him as this arrogant Saudi. You know, those guys were generally poor men. So they saw Osama as this arrogant man, only, you know, half American, using dollars. And they didn't get along, although he did live there for a while. And the claim that Iraq, who was at war, Saddam Hussein was at war with Islamic fundamentalists from the day he took over. The whole thing, I mean, there's so many ways to approach this. But as far as Islam is concerned, it was the worst thing to happen to Islam since the fall of the Ottoman Empire. It ensured that they were going to come under vicious attack from there on in. And that's exactly what happened. So it's a who benefits issue.
Well, Israel definitely benefited. Israel was, it was like, whoopee, hooray. Now they've gone after America. Now we can get America to go after our enemies. That's how it seemed. What do you think about this supposed assassination of Osama bin Laden then that happened years later. I mean, what was that, 12 years later? 15 years later? And you were saying he was on a kidney problems, he had a year to live or something? That was all in the press before this 911 attack, and yet then they claimed that they assassinated him in Pakistan. What do you make of that?
Well, I have an article on it on my Patreon page, and it makes me laugh. The fact that you can shoot a guy like that. By the way, all the people who lived near this compound in Islamabad said nothing happened that day. They all say the same thing. Almost every member of the SEAL team that went in there was killed. And they were killed by going up in a civilian helicopter over Taliban-held territory in Afghanistan, and it was shot down. It's amazing how you put them all in one, almost all of them in one helicopter. So most of these guys are dead. They killed an unarmed man, according to the guy who allegedly did it. Then you take his body and you put it on a ship. No pictures of any of this, by the way. And then you dump his body overboard, claiming that this is Islamic burial practice. There's no burial. You know, there's no Islamic practice. That's what they said. This is what, no one noticed it. No one saw it.
Throwing him off a ship.
You wouldn't think they would find his body. So they said, oh, no, it's normal for Islam to dump bodies overboard, water burial, which I can't find any reference to that. And no one saw it. No one noticed it. Not even the sailors on the ship said that they noticed anything going on. It's an obvious fabrication. And to make this up, it was so easy to do. Not a single picture. You know, they had the cameras, the GoPros on their helmets, which were turned off only when they shot them. And then turned back on again, which is a wild coincidence. You know, I could go on, but this ridiculous story that they needed something strong. They needed something to motivate Americans to get them back into the war again. It's been dragging on for so long. The New York Times, and I cited the day and the article itself, reported that he died in December of 2001, which made a lot of sense because everyone who followed him knew that he was dying anyway. He had severe kidney problems. He was on dialysis. Oh, no dialysis machine in his compound, by the way. So that's how you know it's not true. No one denies that he has severe kidney problems, that he wasn't going to make it. Again, had no money. All of his accounts were frozen. Everything sold off. The Saudis had pushed him away. So his relatives in Saudi Arabia, you know, so that was all gone. He had nothing. Dumping the body overboard and no one notices this. You would think they would want that body. It would be a big deal. And then so when the ship comes to harbor, they said, oh, well, we dumped them overboard because we didn't want to inflame Islamic opinion, which was the official explanation, as if invading these country after country isn't enough. You know, it's laughable. And so it didn't happen. He died a long time ago. Al-Qaeda is more of an FBI, American FBI term than anything else. We know that an alternative translation of Al-Qaeda, by the way, in Arabic is the toilet. It's a slang term for it in Arabic. Like, they're ever going to use that as a name for anything. It's an alternative. It means a database, but also can mean a toilet. And, you know, I've heard people in Arabic countries saying, yeah, we can't wait for the toilet brigade to come in and save us from the Americans. but very few people know this. And it doesn't take, you know, you don't have to, you know, conspiracies don't take very much work to make happen if the press is going to report on it. Yeah, there are people who've been blowing the whistle on this for years and years and years. If the press doesn't report it or take it seriously, it doesn't exist. So, yeah, so the Osama bin Laden was a fake, and a very badly done fake.
And Al-Qaeda are working back again for America now. They started off working for America, fighting in Afghanistan. Then they became the big boogeyman, and now they're back fighting for America again in Syria and the Yemen, I do believe. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Lampshade. God bless and hail victory.
You're tuned